Hello and welcome to another episode of The Wander. My name is Andrew Wilcox. Thanks for joining me again. It's nice to be back. I hope you're doing okay. I know it's been a long couple of years and I haven't put out very many episodes because of that, man. I just didn't want to spend every day talking about, you know, the pandemic and all of that jazz. Because I want to talk about interesting ideas. I want to talk about things that are changing the world, people who are trying to make the world a better place and how we're all headed slowly into the future, or quickly, very quickly into the future, I guess. The world always changing, not knowing exactly what's ahead, but I love talking to passionate people who have big ideas and they're running with them into the unknown, really. On today's show, Donega Markegaard, she's an incredible person to speak to. Seems like just such a driven human being. She's an author. She's a public speaker. She is a ranch owner. She's all about permaculture and regenerative farming and re-energizing the soil with carbon and all sorts of really interesting things that I found so compelling. And she's also just a really great person to speak to. She's got two books. One's called Dawn Again, Tracking the Wisdom of the Wild. The other one is Wolf Girl, Finding Myself in the Wild. She started out in animal tracking and all sorts of interesting things. And definitely, this was a fun episode to talk to her. And one thing that I really appreciated was her love of farmers and ranchers and farming and ranching. And because I love them too, you know, man. Like, it's just such an important part of what we do on this planet is the stewardship of the animals and the land. And it's really cool to talk to her about her connection to all of that. So we'll get to that in just a few seconds. Once again, thank you so much for tuning into the podcast. I hope you have as much of a fun journey as I did listening to Donega. Here she is on The Wander with Andrew Wilcox. What is regenerative agriculture?
Yeah, so regenerative agriculture is a way that we as humans can take part in leaving the earth better than we found it. So how that is applied is through mimicking nature to produce food from healthy soils. And regenerative agriculture has more recently gained popularity and momentum because of the added benefit of sequestering large amounts of carbon into the soil. So there's lots of different techniques of regenerative agriculture, but ultimately it's a way where we can see hope in the future of how we can produce food in a way that is in harmony with nature and produces more life than every life that is taken.
And one thing that I love about this idea, this concept, and the process that you guys are doing is I feel like it is something that's going to be more sustainable, both morally and financially for people as we go forward. I grew up on a small farm and it was eventually semi pushed out through industrialization. And we found through industrialization that essentially the animals get treated worse, the soil gets treated worse and destroyed. Everything just sort of falls apart in industrialization. And this is a way to get back to that, get back away from all of that, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And prior to the large scale industrial agriculture, the farms and ranches were more diverse. So they may have grown crops, but also had animals that would graze crop residue. Maybe they kept bees or other types of agriculture, orchards. And so this is a way that we can look at the best practices of sort of the human history of tending to the wild to really secure our food source and apply that in modern times. And the ultimate model is the indigenous people who stewarded this land before us and who actually lived in harmony and in relationship with all life. And they tended to life because their survival depended on it. Their survival depended on the oak trees being healthy, for the acorn crop, for the grasslands to be open, for the herds of elk to come in to graze that they could then hunt. And so we can honor the earth and honor those who came before us by finding ways that we can also take part in tending the wild. So throughout my life, I've worked a lot with indigenous cultures and people, and certain things I've gotten permission to share, and other things I kind of keep, you know, keep as a gift to, you know, to what was passed on to me. But I think it's important to honor the land that you are living on, that you are growing food on, where your food comes from, and honor those first caregivers, and find ways to give back to that culture in a way that honors that indigenous knowledge and honors those teachers and those holders of that culture and indigenous knowledge.
And I think you touched on a very important word, mentioned it a couple of times, stewardship over ownership of our lands and our and that grows on it and lives on it. So you currently are operating 11,000 acres along with your family in California. How did you get into regenerative agriculture and regenerative ranching?
Well, I was raised in a rural area in Washington State, and always raised close to nature. We had a small organic CSA farm starting to pop up in our area in the Snoqualmie Valley when I was, adolescence and teenager. And we always in my family, we always grew our own food as much as we could from our gardens, and we supported local farms. I didn't eat meat because there wasn't a good source of meat. And my mom sort of ingrained in my mind that these animals were treated poorly in an industrial feedlot, and that, you know, we shouldn't be eating that because that's like we're taking that on ourselves. And that's, their unhealthy life and the way they were raised then in turn translates into us being unhealthy. So so that's really my upbringing sort of helped with the ethos of knowing where your food came from, the basic thing. Where does all of the ingredients of the food that you eat, where does it come from? Trace it to the source. And I encourage everybody to do that. And everybody can and should do that. We should have that type of transparency in our food system. And if you can't find out where the food's coming from, then something is wrong. And then change your diet and eat, source food where you do know that's coming from people that have integrity for the earth, for the wildlife, and also the people that they're feeding, that it's not just a profit-driven model. So then, and I talk about this a lot in my book, Dawn Again, Tracking the Wisdom of the Wild. I was brought to a wilderness survival school. So instead of going to a conventional high school, I went and I studied nature, studied the language of birds, I studied how to track animals to the point where I felt like I was becoming a wild animal myself. And you know, it was a group of us teenagers that would just meet outside every day. We would, in the morning, start a fire by friction, by rubbing sticks together. We would wander through the wet Western Washington forests all day. We learned to hunt and trap and fish and forage and essentially survive on our own in out in the wilderness. And so that school is called the Wilderness Awareness School, and it's still going in Washington. And so that immersion into the language of nature really, it galvanized my vision of finding, and my passions of finding, a way that I could do good with my actions, that I could actually take part in that stewardship and in that regeneration. So that then led me down the path of permaculture and holistic management, and then regenerative agriculture, and sort of finally on the ranch where I am now, where we are stewarding 11,000 acres of land that is territory of the Ramotusholoni, the Coast Miwok, and the Kashaya Pomo. And it's incredible. It's incredible coastal grasslands. And, you know, I have to pinch myself when I drive up into our ranches or ride my horse and look at those views, because, you know, it really is incredible, magical land, and it produces so much food and so much life for, you know, thousands of species of plants and birds and mammals and insects and so much life.
And do you think that our education system does enough to teach kids about this life, about connecting to nature in that way?
Absolutely not. Yeah. There really isn't any required curriculum that comes close to really learning the patterns of nature and taking a holistic approach. So, and in certain communities, especially here where we are, we're close to the San Francisco Bay Area. So we're fortunate enough to have schools where the teachers really care, and there's all kinds of great curriculum and extra curriculum where the science teacher is taking kids out to, you know, and put their waders on and explore the creeks and really immerse themselves and do, you know, getting out there. But you really can't teach this in a classroom setting. Kids need to experience it with all of their senses, and all of those senses engaged without a device.
Yeah, I feel incredibly grateful that I managed to grow up on a farm, and in a diverse farm. At the time, we had, you know, chicken, sheep, cattle, and grain farming. So, you know, I always see that as a huge positive that I had in my life. And I think that part of why we currently have a pretty, I don't know, terrible food system in a lot of ways, and probably both in the States and in Canada, is because of our disconnection from truly understanding where all our food comes from and what it takes to get there. You've also been involved in some policy changes in order to, is that to make this type of thing better? Or is that kind of the goal of some of the work that you've done?
Yeah, I think it really is going to take all of us. And so we work with some pretty large groups on the conservation side and on the ranching side that are really working to shift policy that's very outdated and does not support regenerative agriculture to supporting these kinds of climate smart ways that we can produce food. So, I frequently take part in helping to support certain bills that will support rangeland conservation or wildlife conservation on grasslands or make it so that we're not, because we really literally are going against the grain, we're choosing to opt out of the industrial agriculture system and create our own, you know, grass-fed, regenerative, wildlife-friendly, then we're really up against a lot of walls and a lot of barriers by doing so. So it's sort of my personal goal and challenge to make that transition for other farmers and ranchers easier. Because for us, you know, we've been doing this nearly 18 years and it's been a struggle. I mean, a huge financial struggle, and we've really worked from the ground up to get to where we are. And there's some great, really established farms and ranches that really can't find a way out of sort of feeding into that industrial agriculture system, because there's not another option out there that they see will pay off in the long run. So it's a big risk. And so, you know, and farmers and ranchers shouldn't be the only ones shouldering the burden. Large corporations that have a lot of buying power should help with that transition. Governments should help shoulder some of that risk. And we need to realize that it's not, you know, buying cheap food here is just paying for higher medical costs over here. So if we really focus on food is medicine, and, you know, if this pandemic didn't, you know, it didn't really show us that, then I don't really know what is going to wake people up. But we need to be healthy. We need to build our immune systems. We need to have access to clean air, clean drinking water. It's kind of the basic human rights. And who is going to help create that environment for everyone? It's the farmers and the ranchers. Mm-hmm. Because if you live in an area like places I visited in Kansas, and there's constantly planes flying over spraying glyphosate in the air, and the cancer rate is high, and there's the water is not clean enough to drink, how do you expect people to be healthy? And they're also in food deserts. They can't find good, wholesome, clean food. It's a lot of work that needs to happen. And every single town, you know, needs to have someone that sort of leads the way in regenerative agriculture and shows that it can be profitable and more profitable than industrial agriculture. And then people will start to pay attention.
Well, I think there definitely, one thing you touched on there is the government needs to have policies that really do reflect good animal welfare. Because I think there's a big disconnect, in there's people that the solution to saving the animals is to not eat the animal. And then there's the rest of the people who eat animals, and financially they have to eat what they can get. So they just accept the realities of what it is, not fully even understanding the realities of industrialized agriculture. And what I love about regenerative farming is it sits in the middle of that in true stewardship, in truly caring about animal welfare and creating better food for everybody. And as you said, it is sustainable and can be sustainable, but that has to happen with some changes in government laws. Like, some of the regulations for animal welfare are ridiculous. Like, you know, and on paper, they might not look too bad. Like, you know, something that we call organic that isn't organic, or it's better than some places, but not truly organic. That is just a Band-Aid on a bullet hole. How do we get people to take a closer look at this?
Yeah, I mean, I really think it is going to take the people taking a closer look and really caring and really speaking up, because if we can change that public opinion, then that's when our leaders will really start to shift. And I know there's some changes happening here in the U.S. With the meat industry, and more investments into sort of smaller processing plants. And so I'm hoping that that will kind of trickle down to, grass-fed independent producers. But you just never know how these kinds of things will end up rolling out. But I think that there's certain things that we can look at that we can all agree on, because I think the answer isn't necessarily putting more restrictions on farmers and ranchers, because so many of them are already spread so thin, and they're up against so much debt. And, really, I think it's going to take that farmer to farmer, rancher to rancher, sitting across the kitchen table and figuring out their challenges and what it is going to take to really help make them successful so that they can shift. Because if they're just trying to pay the bills month to month, then they're not going to take any risks. There's no incentive. They don't see an incentive to take those risks. So I think it's really going to take one farmer at a time, one rancher at a time, to really understand each farmer's individual problems and address those and on a really regional level.
And how can the government itself support farmers better and ranchers better?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that there's so much money that goes into subsidizing commodity crops. Mm-hmm. And so that's really the only sure thing to grow is the corn and the soy. And so how can the government shift some of those subsidies and for farmers to grow crops that build carbon in the soil, perennial grains, for example, that incorporate livestock to help promote the carbon cycle and the nutrient cycle in the soils, actually reward farmers for soil carbon, for storing carbon in the soil, and practicing climate smart agriculture. I mean, there's some of that happening, but it's really difficult to access some of those funds, and not every farmer or rancher is going to have the skills to do that. So I think there just needs to be more on the ground work done to figure out the future of food and how we can shift from that industrial commodity crops to regenerative whole foods to feed people, because so much of the grains that are grown are going to feed animals that are standing in a feedlot. Mm-hmm. So the first thing is to get those animals out of the feedlot and put them on grasslands and manage them in a way that's regenerative and holistic, and convert those grasslands that had been converted from prairie to croplands, convert them back to prairie. That supports massive amounts of wildlife and grassland birds. And you can still raise grass-fed beef on the prairie, and it'll actually benefit the wildlife. We work closely, and this is a group that I've helped to them introduce some bills at the state legislature here in California, is the Audubon Society. So the Audubon Society, a very well-respected environmental organization for birds. You know, they're known globally for their bird counts and all of the conservation work they do. They've identified that the largest group of birds in decline is grassland birds. Grassland birds are going extinct. So what did they do? They took a market-based approach and they are getting on the ground. They're putting people on the ground. They're investing millions into this. And they are working with ranchers raising grass-fed beef, and they are working with us to monitor our wildlife, monitor our grasses, monitor our soil carbon, and they're putting their seal of approval of bird-friendly beef on our label, and they are creating media and videos and social media posts to promote regenerative ranchers selling grass-fed beef. So this is a bird conservation group promoting grass-fed beef. And so there's an example right there where we can really work together and we can look at the data, look at the science that, yes, on our ranches, we have an increase of those threatened and endangered birds. Whereas in the valley of California, where crops are grown, those same bird species are declining in numbers. And we have data to show this. We have data to show that we do intensive soil monitoring every 3 years. Mm-hmm. And we are showing on our ranches a 12% increase in soil organic matter. That's huge. And that right there, if all of the ranches were to increase carbon at that rate, that would draw down massive amounts of carbon. Studies that have been done say that only 0.4% increase in soil organic matter on all of the global agriculture soils would essentially halt human-caused emissions. So we're seeing a 12% increase on these rangeland soils where we're mimicking nature, we're grouping the animals together, we're moving them, we're allowing those grasses to recover to through photosynthesis, draw down carbon and store it where it belongs in the soil. So we are, you know, we're doing this and then we have data to show that. So we need to be recognized, and I'm not looking at taking the credit. I mean, it really is mimicking nature. It's just paying attention and observing the cycles of nature, the carbon cycle, the nutrient cycle, the water cycle, and stewarding the land the way the prairie wants to be ranched, mm-hmm. and the way that this land evolved and the way that the indigenous people stewarded this land. And then we'll have incredible results. So we just need to scale that up, and the cattle can actually be a tool. Instead of standing in a feedlot in their own feces and with poor animal welfare conditions and causing pollution because of the concentration and being fed an unhealthy diet of grains that were polluting rivers and grown with massive amounts of chemicals, we can bring those animals out onto the grasslands to do good and to be tools for fire resiliency, for carbon drawdown, for grassland bird habitat. And, you know, I could go on and on and on. Watershed restoration. Yeah. But, you know, it takes people really essentially having that relationship and grounding in nature and nature's cycles.
I think a lot of people don't have an understanding of all of that you just spoke about. I think that people don't know that all of this could truly not just solve some of our food issues, but solve a lot of our environmental issues that we've got going on right now. Because a lot of what we talk about in, you know, dust storms, you know, increasing the size of storms, pollution in the water. All of these things are affected by this industrial agriculture. And as you said, the ranchers and farmers, they're not, you know, they're just trying to keep the food on their own tables and do that stuff. People look at those large ranches and think that all of these people are just rolling in dough, and they're all struggling. I grew up in that struggle where my dad fought every day to keep the lands that he leased, and lots of farmers around us did the same thing. And we watched as all of our small little family farms slowly became ownership of three or four families. And nothing against those families either. Those families are struggling too. The system doesn't work in the way that it's currently put together. We need to make some changes. So you have two books out, Dawn Again and Wolf Girl. What inspired you to write those books?
Yeah, well, I had known I'd always wanted to write a book. I love to write. I love to journal, reflect, observe, you know, journal my observations in nature. And I was approached by a publisher after she had listened to a podcast that I did. At the time, it was Modern Farm Girls. Now it's Sustainable Dish with Diana Rogers. And I had talked about my time in the Idaho wilderness tracking wolves. And that was really influential in my life and a way that I could really immerse myself in that predator-prey relationship of when you have predators in a landscape and you have large herds of animals, they are moving them. And in turn, those animals are moving the vegetation around them and moving the soil. So, and in my youth, in my teenage and early 20s, I spent 7 summers in the largest tract of wilderness in the lower 48 in Idaho, following these packs of wolves. So I recounted one story in that podcast, and this publisher, had been searching for a book that was written by a woman who had a background in wilderness survival and sort of gone a different route for school. And I was a high school dropout and I completely immersed in nature. And she wanted to sort of, it was almost because she was choosing to take her kids out of conventional schooling and put them in these nature schools. And, but she hadn't known anyone who had gone that route and sort of made a career out of it. So as so many, as being a parent myself, you know, you're constantly doubting yourself. Like, am I making the right choices? Are my kids, are they surrounded in the right environment? Or, you know, am I feeding them healthy? Like, you have all of these questions when you're a parent. And so she asked me to write this book about my life growing up, learning the language of nature, being adopted by a Lakota holy man, and really learning these indigenous spiritual ways along with being a naturalist and wilderness survivalist, and then how I sort of used my background in my current career as a regenerative rancher. And so it's my books are a lot of adventure stories. and I really wanted people to see themselves in that story, that we all have access to nature. It's a human right. And we, no matter our background, our culture, our upbringing, how old we are, we can all step out into a nearby park or a river or an ocean or a lake and find that solace in nature. And by immersing in nature, we're learning more about ourselves and about our passions. And it's kind of like that question you asked earlier is, are schools doing enough or are they doing anything to really teach kids about nature and about the cycles of life and how everything is interconnected? And it's been proven, and I know Richard Louv with his book, Last Child in the Woods, and his more recent book, I think it's Vitamin N, talks about this, that it's, you know, it's been proven with data that those youth or kids that have had that access to nature and those the training to be a naturalist, you know, you don't need to quite go as far as I went with, you know, being able to walk out with, you know, just a knife on your in your pocket and the clothes on your back, but just learning about nature, learning about the birds and the trees and the plants and the soil and the microbes and the fish. Basically, if you learn that in your youth, you will then turn into an environmentalist in your adult life, and you will inherently do something of value for the earth. So right there, that is something that we can do. We can bring our kids and teach them about nature, have them find a special spot where they go and they sit and they journal their observations. And we talk about it, and you have, like, you know, the first thing you see when you come into my front door is a bookshelf full of field guides. And, you know, we don't pick them up every day, but they're there. So the kids know if they want to identify a bird or a plant or a tree or just thumb through them, they're there. So you sort of help to surround the kids with an environment where they are curious and want to learn about the sort of non-human life around them, and have a chance where they can shut down and set down their device and go out and sit around a campfire or walk along a river barefoot. And the more we can do that for ourselves, for our children, for our families, then the better off we're all going to be.
Absolutely. You got me inspired. I noticed that you have speaking engagements. Is this the type of stuff that you speak about in your speaking engagements, or is there a variety of topics?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of, it all kind of boils down to having that relationship with nature, and then where we can go with that, with our food system, with regenerative agriculture, with policy. And I speak to a number of different groups, the Environmental Protection Agency, Google, Tesla. You know, I do a number of retreats, and like I've got a retreat this coming weekend at Canyon Ranch here in California, and where I'm working with a chef. So really helping people to immerse in their senses and nourish their bodies. So how can we also, in the food that we eat and the way we prepare it, connect with that sort of intuition and that sensory experience that we get when we're out in nature, and basic techniques that you can take home and really take action in regenerative agriculture and helping to, you know, promote the solutions for climate change. And so yeah, the chef Isabel Jackson Nunes and I will, you know, we're looking at other places. I think we might be talking to a retreat center up in Canada so that we can really have these more immersive experiences in nature and food and regenerative agriculture and work with people to really sort of create those healthy living habits. So that we can, you know, we can change one person at a time, one region at a time, one farm at a time.
I had a conversation with somebody a while ago, and I said that I think that more people should get into agriculture, and we need to figure out a way to have small family farms be a viable thing for some people. And the people I was speaking to were like, well, most people, I don't know if they want a farm. And I said, I believe that most people want to be connected to nature. And I think that you would probably agree. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, definitely farming's not for everybody. It's hard work. And, I know that like along the West Coast and certain areas where I go to conferences and things, there's a big movement for young farmers, which is awesome. It's so great to get like first generation farmers, and some of them are incredible and they really succeed. But I would say the majority of them, start out their first, second year, and it's like, this isn't for me.
Yeah.
And they go on and do something else, but they've always, it's kind of like that. That's always part of them, that experience of farming and growing their food. But, in terms of people wanting to be connected to nature, that, really at the, especially a couple of years ago at the start of this pandemic, that was so much at the forefront of people's minds. And, they knew that they could be connected to nature just by purchasing from our ranch, because they knew that we were connected to nature.
Mm-hmm.
And we were doing good to help keep the grasslands healthy and drawing down carbon and creating fire resiliency. And, we've seen so many extreme weather events and, traumatic crises across the globe. And, so many large scale fires that really impact everybody. I mean, because that's the air that we breathe. And so the more people understand that we can do something about that, and we need to do something about that, it's long overdue. So, it's just a matter of really working to support those people that are on the ground. You don't necessarily need to be a farmer or rancher yourself, but go and track the source of your food and build a relationship with the people that are growing the food and ask them about the wildlife on their farm. And they might get all excited and tell you about the mountain lion they saw, or they might kind of give you a blank stare. So, and say, oh, that's, we can't have wildlife because of food safety or something like that. So, mm-hmm. It's all about relationship building.
Yeah. What are some things an individual can do outside of connecting with their farmers, what an individual can do to support regenerative agriculture or learn more about it?
Yeah, I think I'm just a fan of learn by doing and immersing your senses as much as possible. Get your hands in healthy soils, because there's also microbes in the soil that help you, that increase serotonin so that you can be happier. And so get your hands dirty and grow something. And because every green plant that you grow is drawing down carbon. So whether it's a garden, a community garden, or something on your apartment balcony or in your windowsill, grow something, herbs to add to your food, some vegetables, so that you can really learn how that cycle works. And then purchase from soil savvy farmers or ranchers. Find out if they're monitoring their soil carbon. Are they using compost? Are they composting on farm? Are they integrating animals? Are they focusing on diversity of plants, perennials, pollinator species? Are they working in their community to address equity and diversity in their human community as well? Are they treating their workers fairly? I mean, you can't have regenerative agriculture without having equity in sort of the farms worker system as well. And how do we work to build an equitable food system if the people that are growing our food don't have access to clean water and don't have access to safe housing? And that is happening. And so we need to look at that as part of regenerative agriculture as well. And how do we have a food system which honors all of the people that are growing the food? And it really takes getting in there because it's complex and it's challenging. But we've got some incredible groups here in California that are really advocating for farm worker rights and farm worker pay. And, you know, I would say like a ranch like ours, where we're established, we're successful in the Bay Area, we have a great customer base, we can pay a better wage, mm-hmm. you know, so that the people that are working on our farms do have access to, you know, good, safe housing for them and their families. So that's not happening in industrial agriculture. They're built upon cheap labor that they can, and populations that have immigrated here and don't have the same rights as citizens. And it's really devastating to see how these communities are, you know, basically forced to live by the, you know, by industrial agriculture, by the big agribusinesses. So we need to really be shedding light on that as well. It's not just about nature, it's about, you know, human rights as well.
And healthcare.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so I think that, you know, those are some good steps. You know, we talked about journeying to the source of your food, taking action. You know, the youth climate movement was really strong before COVID. It's still strong. There's a great group that started in our area, but that has become global, called Heirs to Our Oceans. And that's a youth climate group that goes into schools and teaches about, you know, ocean activism and how we can work with regenerative agriculture and indigenous communities that are most impacted by climate change. And this is a youth-led movement that's working on policy and education and advocacy to really create a better earth for all. So figure out what choices that we can make, that each one of you can make to help the future generations, to promote life, to promote a healthier planet for your children and their children yet to come. And how can we all work together to promote that? And everybody's going to have their own role. Yeah. You know, you don't need to be like me and walk out into the wilderness and survive. But you can, you know, you can do other things in your own community that are going to support nature and support the regenerative agriculture movement.
Perfect. I think that's a great place for us to wrap everything up. I usually just end it off with what I call read, watch, and listen, something that people should read, something that people should watch, and something that people should listen to. And it doesn't have to be a movie or TV show or song. Anything that comes to mind when I say read, watch, or listen. So read.
I would say Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. That's a really great one.
I actually just bought that book as a gift for a friend of mine because I heard it was so good and I have to read it myself. What about watch?
Oh gosh, Kiss the Ground. If you haven't seen it, yeah. You must watch Kiss the Ground. We're featured in that documentary, and it really has kickstarted the global regenerative agriculture movement. It's gained so much popularity because of the star-studded cast. And I even got to be on a Zoom conversation with Prince Charles earlier last year. And so it really has gained popularity and helped to shift policy and shift public opinion to support regenerative agriculture and soil health. So definitely watch Kiss the Ground. It's available on Netflix or what is the other one? Vimeo, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's also, I noticed they had on the website, they have a free version that you can show students as well. There's a student version. Yeah. That can
and
be shown.
That's a great one. I actually really, really encourage that because my uncle, who's Oglala Lakota, Tony Ten Fingers, is featured in that one. So I actually kind of encourage people to watch that educational version because they do bring in some of the indigenous perspective. Oh, wow.
And listen.
Oh, gosh. Well, I listen to a lot of books on tape. I listen to the birds, like in the morning, I'm always out listening to birds. And I think that's really key for me, listening to nature. And especially, I like to start my day with that. So go out, whether it's, taking a walk, taking a run, or just sitting quietly and listening to the birds.
Perfect. And we'll leave it at that. Thank you very much for your time, Dinaga. It's been really great to talk to you. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I love these conversations because I go in with one thought process and come out with another often. And I learned a lot from you and I appreciate that. And I hope others do as well. So thank you very much for your time.
Great. Thank you. Enjoy.